Hello and welcome to this week's Arab Digest podcast. I'm William Law, editor of the Digest. Arab Digest is something of a rarity in Middle East analysis. Our daily newsletter has no sponsors, and we carry our podcasts without any advertising. It's our readers who support Arab Digest, and we intend to keep it that way. To find out how you can support a truly independent voice in the Middle East and North Africa, head to arabdigest.org. When you go to the website, check out how you can receive our reader-supported daily newsletter for 2 months for free. That's right, 2 months for free. My guest today, and a podcast regular, I'm happy to say, is Caroline Rose. Caroline is the director of the Strategic Blind Spots portfolio at the New Lines Institute in Washington, D.C., where she leads and produces research on the intersection of defense, security, illicit trades, and geopolitical landscapes from Europe to the Middle East and North Africa. Her portfolio at the Institute includes two projects, the project on the Capticon trade and the project on post-withdrawal security landscapes. And it's the latter that we'll be talking about today. Caroline, welcome back to the podcast. Always great to have you on.
Thanks so much for having me back, Bill.
Now, look, before we take a look at U.S. withdrawals in the Middle East, I want to ask you, first of all, for your take on what happens next with President Biden telling Benjamin Netanyahu, if you hit Iran, we will not join in. Is Biden bluffing? And what happens if Netanyahu decides to call that bluff?
So I don't necessarily think that the Biden administration is bluffing, given the fact that really, when you look at the incentive structure in the Middle East, the United States is seeking to de-escalate rather than embroil itself in a spillover of the Gaza war into the Levant and into the greater Middle East. And for the United States, it just simply does not have the capacity on the ground to withstand additional attacks from Iran directly, as well as Iran-aligned militias in both Northeast Syria and in Iraq. Now, it's naval assets that have been staged in the Red Sea, in the Mediterranean. That's a different story. And that's played a very prominent role in trying to intercept these attacks. But when it comes to a broadened, more escalated dynamic between Israel and Iran, the United States simply wants to prevent that. And I think that the United States, while it has committed itself in defense of Israel, especially with this last round of escalation, we've seen that the United States ultimately does want to try and persuade the Netanyahu government to back down on its bold moves that have been made against Iran and Iran-aligned militias.
I guess that's the question, though, isn't it? Because Netanyahu is rather beholden to the extremists in his cabinet, particularly Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich. He is a shrewd operator, certainly, but, you know, the threat is that if he doesn't play hardball and serious hardball with Iran, which could provoke a broader regional war, then Ben-Gvir will bring him down. What do you think? Another bluff there?
Absolutely. And I think that part of the play and part of the playbook that was undertaken in striking Iran and the diplomatic mission in Damascus in the first place was a strategy to try and intertwine and embed the United States further in backing Israel. I think Netanyahu and his advisors, they knew very well that the United States was starting to fray over the offensive that was being conducted, especially when they were trying to expand that into Rafah. But they believed that trying to then create some regional spillover, given the existing tensions and the lack of trust that the United States had with Iran, they believed that this would somehow really solidify the United States support. And I think that it could potentially backfire. We've seen that now with Biden's recent statement, as well as, of course, the fact that the United States really does not only want to embroil itself in a regional spillover, but additionally, it just, as of now, does not have the capacity to do so. If the United States were to commit itself much more behind Israel in a broadened regional war, this would involve a scale of ground, air, naval assets that really I don't think that the United States wants to commit itself to in an election year.
Yeah, that's the point. It's an election year. They absolutely do not. I was listening to John Bolton, who's being interviewed on BBC today, and Bolton, of course, was going all in for hitting Iran and hitting Iran hard, if not with military weaponry, then with cyber attacks. But we're just going to have to wait and see as all of us are really on the edge of our seats on this one. But look, let's go back, rather, let's go on to the withdrawal scenario. You mentioned Syria and Iraq. Okay, well, what happens, and what do you think the likelihood of a U.S. withdrawal from Iraq and Syria is, again, given that we're in this election year?
Certainly. So I think that it's a crucial time to be having discussions like these, especially in the wake of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, where they're really, we witnessed an evacuation rather than a full-scale withdrawal strategy, and one that was coordinated not only with Afghan national forces, but also with U.S. partners that were staged in the region. And I think that now it's time to have this frank discussion, an open discussion, and even a debate about what a withdrawal from Iraq and Syria would look like. Looking at the security realities, the operational environment, and discussing about, you know, discussing the implications, the security implications that would be left in a partial or full-scale withdrawal's wake. Now, when we look at the likelihood for withdrawal in Iraq and Syria under Operation Inherent Resolve, interestingly, there are right now discussions with the Higher Military Commission between the United States and Iraq that are reviewing the mandate and the mission and really the purpose, as well as, of course, the timeline of the coalition and its presence in Iraq. I think that ultimately there is a higher likelihood of the United States departing from Syria than there is in Iraq. I think that the mission might change in Iraq. It might evolve from an anti-ISIS mission into something that is a bit more bilateral and long-term and capacity building. However, the con and the downside to changing that mission to something that is a bit more bilateral is the fact that it would only increase the pressure from the popular mobilization forces, the coalition framework that has supported Sudani, and they would, of course, rack up major both military, but also political pressure against him as prime minister.
Just mention, remind us who Sudani is.
So Sudani is the prime minister of Iraq. He actually right now, as we're speaking, is in Washington to meet the Biden administration and to discuss the future of U.S.-Iraq relations, which is quite interesting, especially as we see these strikes ensue in the region.
Well, it's interesting. You're saying more likely out of Syria withdrawal than out of Iraq. But you also mentioned that chaotic withdrawal in Afghanistan, which really blotted Biden's copybook. How much has that damaged U.S. credibility in the Middle East?
I think immensely. I think that, you know, there was a reality that the United States was always going to disengage as it was seeking to bolster its great power competition capabilities. We've seen constantly through Department of Defense planning documents and strategies that have been released in the last few years that the United States is increasingly looking to focus on the Pacific, on countering China, also, of course, countering Russia as it wages its war in Ukraine. So there was always this assumed reality. But then once we saw the withdrawal from Afghanistan, I think it was a lesson that the United States could have contingency and evacuation plans, but when it came down to it, there was really no plan for or mitigating the fallout and the security implications of this new power vacuum. And I think now many are looking at the Middle East, looking at Syria and Iraq, and the results are almost just as obvious. In Syria, of course, we would have a convergence of powers and both external actors as well as key players in Syria, for example, the Syrian regime. You would also, of course, have Turkey, Russia, Iran, and Iran-aligned militias that would all seek to try and salvage and scramble and establish different areas of influence. as well as counter the SDF, which has been a key partner of the United States in Northeast Syria. In Iraq, a very similar dynamic in that Iran-aligned militias, I think, would deepen their footholds as well as their political influence in the sphere. You would have Turkey that would double down on its existing aerial campaign in northern Iraq, particularly in the Qandil Mountains against PKK insurgents. You would also likely have other powers, even great powers like Russia and China, try and see, you know, where they could salvage and create an area of influence and try and fill that vacuum that the United States left behind. So it's very key to game out these post-withdrawal security dynamics, I think, especially as we are now approaching a dynamic in the Middle East where escalation is incredibly high. We haven't seen this level of escalation between Israel and Iran ever. And so because of this, one strike against a U.S. installation or one error or mistake that could be made could cost lives, could cost American personnel. And with that, there would be immense political pressure that could induce a very speedy withdrawal, a withdrawal that the Department of Defense has not planned. And instead, it would look more like an evacuation rather than a phased, slow, and incremental withdrawal process.
Wow. Yeah. So Afghanistan 2.0, then, which is a worrying scenario. And of course, America's credibility is already severely damaged by its, I would almost say unflinching, but I'll qualify that a little bit by its support for Israel in the Gaza war. I do think that Washington fully grasps the extent to which it has damaged itself in the Middle East, North Africa, and indeed throughout the global South. Is Washington aware of just how much anger and how much contempt has been stirred up by the way that the Biden administration has handled the Gaza war?
Yes, I think there is that recognition as the United States continues to try and convene different actors to the table when it comes to even a ceasefire over Gaza, coordinating with intermediaries, trying to get even Netanyahu and his government on board with trying to establish a consensus, even a timeline for the offensive. And I think that's where this administration, as well as the previous administration, there, of course, were errors that were made in the Middle East that also created this the sense that the United States was going to disengage. For example, the Trump administration, they initially withdrew from Northeast Syria. They conducted also a major withdrawal and a partial withdrawal from Iraq after the Soleimani strikes. So because of this, I think that, you know, it's been successive administrations that have created this lack of bargaining power and diplomatic, I would say, diplomatic prowess in the region that has really hurt how the United States could be proactive and engage both in fields of diplomacy, but also as a security actor. And unfortunately, I think that has created a lot of distrust with many of its existing partners in the region.
Yeah, and remind us, Caroline, I mean, the actual numbers, the military commitment in Syria and Iraq of Americans' boots on the ground, is not that big, is it?
No, it's a very, very small kind of sliver of U.S. forward posture. I mean, in Syria, we have 900 personnel stationed there. That doesn't include contractors, but that's extremely small. And then when we look to Iraq, it's 2,500, also not including contractors. But I mean, it's very, very small. And even in 2020, the United States nearly halved its personnel count in Iraq. And then, of course, after the Trump administration's kind of temporary withdrawal and, you know, once they bolstered the United States presence there, we also saw the United States forward posture in Northeast Syria dwindle. So it's very small. It's very also a cheap mission in the sense of the United States, you know, they have a lot of joint installations. It's an advise and assist mission. While, of course, they have to act in a defensive capacity when they're struck by Iran-aligned militias, they're primarily there to help partners on the ground conduct anti-ISIS raids and help build capacity amongst these partners like the SDF, the KSF, ISF, the CTS, across Syria and Iraq. And really, because of this, it's a very small footprint and a cheap footprint.
You're listening to the Arab Digest podcast with me, William Law, and from Washington, D.C., the New Line Institute's Caroline Rose. Arab Digest is a truly independent voice on the Middle East and North Africa. No advertising and no sponsors. In the information overload world in which we all find ourselves, Arab Digest keeps it simple. One insightful article a day and the weekly podcast from top experts, analysts, writers, and commentators. A team of contributors you will not find anywhere else. Check us out on arabdigest.org. When you go to the website, be sure and look out for the offer of a free 2-month trial to our reader-supported daily newsletter. Well, let's look now at ISIS. First of all, in Syria, how do you assess their current strength? And again, I mean, what are the implications if this, you know, small force of American soldiers pulls out? What does that do? I mean, I get the feeling that ISIS is much stronger, perhaps, than a lot of people are aware.
Certainly. And I think when you look at, quarterly reports that the Office of the Inspector General, they release every quarter to Congress, essentially reporting on how our forces are doing, the progress that's being made with these partners, as well as, of course, the operational environment. And ISIS is a key component of that because the coalition has a very, very narrow counter-ISIS mission. And when you look at these reports, it's very clear, and it doesn't make news headlines because, you know, ISIS is not and by no means in the position that it was in the mid to 2010s. However, we've seen a series of, low level, less sophisticated, however, consistent attacks that have been made against civilians as well as U.S. partners that are operating in the region. There's also, of course, in northeast Syria, been a very specific and great concern about potential jailbreaks from ISIS detention centers, as well as widespread recruitment in camps like Al-Hol. And because the facilities are not properly guarded, there's also a lot of distraction when there's a Turkish offensive in northeast Syria. This creates kind of the perfect storm for an ISIS resurgence, especially regaining momentum throughout northeast Syria, recruiting en masse, trying to conduct jailbreaks, and then more sophisticated attacks against both the SDF, the United States, communities, civilians, and then, of course, trying to regain different swaths of territory. We've also seen in northeast Syria that they've made particular gains in the Badia, which is the Syrian desert. And there is a prevailing concern, it's not there yet, that they would be able to connect if they were given an opportunity. And if they had that breakout moment, they would try and connect territory into Idlib province, where they, of course, could coordinate and connect with Al-Qaeda-affiliated organizations that are operating in the northwest of Syria. So, and then, of course, they would also try and make gains into Iraq as well, where there are ISIS cells that are actively operating and conducting attacks.
Yeah, and well, let's look at Iraq now, because, it was my sense that Baghdad would like to see the Americans in a phased withdrawal. But what's the situation with ISIS there?
Yes, so I'll make kind of two comments on that. With ISIS in Iraq, I think it really depends on where and where we're operating. When you look at, for example, northern Iraq, and when we're talking about the Kurdish security forces, these reports are, reporting back more effective counter-ISIS missions. Sometimes, not much progress at all because they don't necessarily deem any threats. Whereas when it comes to parts of southern Iraq or even along the Syrian-Iraqi border, that's where you have much more of a need for consistent counter-ISIS missions. And that is primarily with the ISF and the CTS. That being said, when it comes to, when we talk about whether Iraq wants the United States to conduct a full-scale withdrawal, I think it's very important to remember that Sadani is in very much of a bind, the prime minister of Iraq. he was elected with the help of a framework and a coalition that is primarily affiliated and aligned with Iran. And because of that, they also have major security influence through the Popular Mobilization Forces, which has received an increased budget as well as the ability to recruit more members. They've also received a swath of different contracts as well, which is very important for them to kind of expand their footprint in Iraq. And Sudani is also, of course, he enjoys the support of a number of other actors that are operating in this political space. But he knows that the pressure that has been mounted by these Iran-aligned actors is only going to increase unless he tries to induce a military withdrawal from the United States. That being said, the United States provides millions in security assistance as well as, you know, humanitarian assistance. They are a major influence in Iraq's security infrastructure as well as, you know, their governmental structure. And because of this, you know, Sudani doesn't necessarily want to lose that either. And if the United States were to conduct a withdrawal, he would have a much harder time scrambling to gain political approval and backing from a number of different coalitions, both within the Sunni community as well as the Kurdish community, that is key to avert any political crisis and a paralysis within the Iraqi political landscape, like we've seen in years before. And so because of this, Sudani, I think, is in a very difficult spot. He doesn't quite want the United States to leave, but he wants to achieve some sort of quick political win that keeps the key political blocks at bay. And because of this, we might see kind of a shift in the nature and the mission of the coalition that might satisfy or might compromise a number of these different political coalitions. But, you know, that might result in a partial withdrawal, but I don't necessarily see Iraq pushing for a full-scale, quick withdrawal from the United States, unless these Shia militias are able to wield more and considerable influence.
Okay. Boy, talk about walking on a razor's edge on that one for Sudani. And of course, if there was a withdrawal from either Syria or Iraq, Tehran would declare that as a big win, I'm sure, as I suppose ISIS would as well. So there's that at play. But let us assume that Biden does not pull U.S. forces out before 5th of November, which from what you're saying is a fairly comfortable assumption. And let us also assume that he wins the election. Beyond backing Israel, do you see a coherent Middle East and North Africa strategy emerging? Because honestly, Caroline, I'm finding it hard to find one in his current term.
No, I don't think that the United States has a coherent Middle East strategy. I think that, you know, from the Trump administration onward, it's been put on autopilot in a sense of, you know, we scrambled together these normalization deals. We were trying to diversify our relationships beyond the security sphere and ultimately work on disengaging from the region. And I think that past year has been a very important reality check to the United States as well as its partners that were looking to disengage from the region and demonstrate that you really cannot do so. You cannot have your cake and eat it too. You cannot wish to be an influential actor in the diplomatic space and convene, you know, a ceasefire deal while also constantly talking about how you wish to disengage from the region. The United States needs to stay engaged in the Middle East. You know, it needs to remain a proactive and active actor in this space, regardless of how its security posture looks like. And I think that this has been a reality check. I think that the United States, we assumed that, you know, the Palestinian issue was something of the past, and that regional solidarity with Palestinian communities was waning. I think the United States also discarded, you know, any sort of crisis between Israel and Palestinian actors. as well as regional support for Palestine. And because of that, I think that's why we've seen such a prolonged, really catastrophic offensive happen in Gaza. And of course, this resulting humanitarian disaster as well.
Yeah, okay. Well, let me put another assumption to you, Caroline. Donald Trump wins. A quick pullout of U.S. forces in Iraq and Syria, veering towards a position of grand isolationism. I mean, what would a Trump administration mean for the Middle East, North Africa?
It's a great question. And this is something I've been trying to grapple with. I think that there are actually two possibilities with the Trump administration. You could either see full-scale isolationism, which of course resulted in the strategies that we saw in Syria in 2019, as well as Iraq in 2020, which was really scaling down the United States' forward posture there. However, we also have an administration, at least judging, you know, with the last Trump administration, that is extremely aligned when it comes to Israel. I think we could potentially also see the United States really commit itself behind Israel with this offensive, not only, you know, double or even triple our arms sales to Israeli forces, but additionally, you could also see a potential strategy that commits U.S. troops and more personnel in not only in the Mediterranean and Red Sea, but potentially on the ground. This is especially, I think, also contingent on how many Iran hawks are positioned in a Trump administration. The last administration, we saw a lot of Iran hawks. And if that is the case, and if we do see continued Iran-Israeli escalation and you know, shared strikes, that could be a possibility that I think is worth exploring with a Trump administration. We need to consider. We could have very two opposite kind of sides of the spectrum when it comes to a policy in the Middle East.
Yeah, you know, John Bolton interview, when he was asked a similar question, he said, "I don't know. All I know is that whatever Trump does from one day to the next is based on only one thing, which is what is best for Donald Trump. He doesn't have right. Foreign policy agenda. He doesn't have a foreign policy mind. He doesn't think that way. He thinks what is best for Donald Trump on any given day. And that for the Middle East and for the rest of us is kind of a scary scenario."
Very much so. Very much so. And I think it's worth remembering too that, you know, the Trump administration really engaged with Israel, and of course they ushered the Abraham Accords. That's something that I think they will be a centerpiece of the administration no matter what, trying to, of course, commit itself and commit U.S. support, increased U.S. support behind Israel. I think that is a no-brainer, no matter whether they would militarily disengage or bulk up U.S. personnel in the region.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see. And as you say, with the Abraham Accords, Trump did something that no other president had done. He moved the needle. He shifted things in a way that hadn't been shifted really in decades. My goodness, we're living in interesting times, aren't we, Caroline?
Very much so. It's very sad too. I mean, I think that, you know, there was a lot of progress being made, you know, just under a year ago. And now with this new reality, we're seeing unprecedented escalation. And at the end of the day, it's these communities on the ground that are suffering and experiencing the implications of all of this. So it's a very sad reality. And it's been a very sad year in the Middle East, indeed.
Yeah, it has. And as you say, unprecedented human suffering that we're seeing on a daily basis in Palestinian territories. Well, I guess we'll have to leave it there. And I thank you very much, Caroline. Another fascinating conversation.
Thank you so much, Bill, for having me. It was a pleasure.
My guest today on the Arab Digest podcast was the New Lines Institute's Caroline Rose. You'll have noticed we bring you the podcast with no advertising and no sponsors. We are a truly independent source for analysis and commentary on the Middle East and North Africa. If you'd like to support our independent voice, head to our website at arabdigest.org, where you can find out about our reader-supported daily newsletter and how to get a free two-month trial. The newsletter features the very best of MENA analysts, commentators, and writers, contributors like Caroline. Check us out on arabdigest.org. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn, and search our library of more than 200 podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, SoundCloud, or Amazon. Have a look for Caroline's excellent work on Syria and the Capticon trade. Our podcast guests provide unique insights, insights you simply will not find anywhere else. Thanks for listening. I'm William Law, editor of the Arab Digest, essential reading, essential listening from independent sources.